on Zion of Doubt. First of all, I want to welcome all of you here and give you a yasher koach for participating in this breakfast suda this morning. Since this is a mitzvah gathering, I will not say thank you. We do not say thank you for performing a mitzvah, since that would undercut the mitzvah aspect of the deed. Yasher koach is, however, appropriate. I extend a heartfelt yasher koach to all who are present here this morning. May Hashem give each and every one of you the strength to continue to do many more mitzvot and good deeds for many years in good health, and may they be in the main for joyous occasions. This morning, we will reverse the order we usually follow in our program. Ordinarily, we begin with an introduction to the concept of a Chevra Kadisha gathering on Zion Adar, and then we hear our guest speaker. However, today, since our speaker has commitments which require him to leave early, we will begin with his talk and then go on to the other aspects of the program that we usually start with. So we're going to ask Jeff Greenberg, Rabbi Jeff Greenberg, to introduce our very distinguished speaker.
I'm quite pleased to welcome Rabbi Daniel Feldman to join us today. I think this is the first time we're having you speak
here. No, he's spoken in the show. I wanted to mention that. And what? I still remember you spoke about Simchas Rosh Hashanah.
Right. Excellent. So welcome back. Rabbi Feldman is a Magid Shir at YU in the Beit Midrash program. He's also director of rabbinic research at the Center for Jewish Future at YU, and I believe the director of YU Publications. He's also a former scriptwriter for the Yeshiva Purim Spiel.
Hopefully former.
Okay. And the author of a number of Svarim, one of which is called The Right and the Good, Halacha and Human Relations, and three books in Hebrew titled Bina V'Sefarim. He's also the spiritual leader of Congregation Eitz Chaim in Teaneck. And without further ado,
the topic
obviously today, as being a Chevra Kadisha breakfast, is Nichma Velim, and I hope it'll be tremendously informative and, knowing Rabbi Feldman, somewhat entertaining.
Thank you very much, Shikach and Rabbi Shneiman. It is good to be back. Today, of course, is a day when we focus a little bit less on entertainment, but more on chesed as a whole, and specifically the chesed that is more somber, chesed that involves the mace, it's the yard side of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that directs our attention to topics of kvura, but really, more broadly, topics of chesed as a whole, because the mandate of chesed, the obligation to engage in helping each other, comes from a number of sources. There are two main sets of sources, two main families of sources within the Torah. On the one hand, we have the very well-known pasuk, the klal gadol b'Torah, so to speak, of v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, that we are to love our neighbors, love our fellow as ourselves. And the Rambam writes in Hilchos Evel, appropriately, where he lists all the acts of chesed, that everything that we do in this category is subsumed, is a part of v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. He then goes on to have a little bit of a mysterious statement where he suggests that the various categories, nicham aveilim, bikur cholim, Achnasas Kala, Achnasas Orchim, etc., are rabbinical enactments that the rabbis came and created specific categories within the broad concept of chesed, which is a little bit of a discussion why that's necessary if we already understand that it's all contained within chesed. But be that what it is, we understand that V'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha is a general directive towards engaging in chesed. But in addition to that, there's another half of the coin. And that is, there's also a concept of V'halachta B'drachav, that we're told to walk in God's path, which is a mitzvah which appears in one form or another at least eight times in Sefer Dvarim alone, and is also contained within various other contexts, some of which we read recently in Parshas Yisro and in Parshas Bashalach, different psukim which Chazal understand, all directing us to say that we should imitate God's ways, we should follow in His path, and that His path is primarily that of chesed, that is the core interpretation that the rabbis give to this idea that being godlike, being divine in our character, means engaging in chesed just as God does. So therefore, when we look to today, we look to Zayin Adar, which is a day not only when Moshe Rabbeinu passed away, but when he was buried by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which the Gemara in Sota understands to be one of the framing events of the Torah. The Torah begins and ends with chesed, because it ends with God's burying Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore this is one of the sources of chesed as a whole, that we're told to imitate God's behavior in this type of activity and to engage in acts of chesed. So therefore, any topic of chesed is really appropriate, especially for Zayin Adar, but we do understand that we focus more directly on themes related to Kavod HaMeis and things surrounding that type of sad event. And very often the focus is on the Chevra Kadisha and themes of Kfura. But we chose a topic for today which encompasses a little bit more of the population, and that topic of Nicham Avelim, which of course is a closely related topic, but one which also addresses both the mourners, both the survivors, and the Mace himself, and the Nifter as well. And this is because there is a statement that the Rambam primarily made famous, the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah, that one who engages in Nichum Avelim, one who engages in what we normally translate as comforting mourners, is really doing a double chesed. It's doing a chesed on two different levels, because it is a chesed clearly for the mourners, for the surviving family, but it's also a chesed for the mace. It's also something which is considered to be in keeping with the covet of the Nifter as well. And this apparently is drawing on a statement the Gemara has in Maseches Shabbos and Daf Kuftin Beis, where the Gemara says that the spirit, the neshama of the one who passed away, continues to circle, continues to be present for a 7-day period. And therefore, those who come to the house, which is the reason why it's often suggested when possible that Shiva be sat in the house of the Nifter himself, that the house is where the neshama continues to have a presence, and that the act of Nicham Avelim is simultaneously a service both to the surviving family, to the mourners, and to the mace as well. Therefore, the Rambam says you're accomplishing two things at once. This should be considered a double chesed. And that's why, again, based on the Gemara, it's a little bit of a question how to read the Gemara, but the Rambam seems to understand that if you have somebody who passes away who doesn't have any family members, if there aren't any clear mourners, so nonetheless, he says, a minion of 10 men should go to the house and should sit there. And the way the Rambam seems to understand, the Ravid questions it a little bit, but the way the Rambam seems to read the Gemara is that these people should come and be substitute mourners, that even though there aren't any mourners who are actually experiencing the grief process, the Nifter himself deserves to have this type of process going on, and therefore people should voluntarily sit in the house and act as mourners. And it's a fascinating concept, especially because we talk about a minion. So when somebody dies and they do have relatives, so we don't have a concept that the Shiva house necessarily has to have a minion. The family is usually less than a minion. You don't necessarily require a minion in order to have a Shiva when there are relatives. So Rabbi Sal Stern, who wrote the Tshuva Spetzel HaChachma, he has a little bit of a discussion about this, and he suggests that this is to compensate, that a particular pain, the spiritual pain to a nifter who didn't have any family, so we have to compensate for that by bringing a minion, when even if there was a family, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a minion, and that's usually not the case. But in any event, this, just parenthetically, is perhaps the source that later Sfarim built on, that there is a concept also that one can volunteer for Avelus, that we don't necessarily have to assume that it's only blood relatives who can sit Shiva, but there are circumstances where maybe somebody who's not a blood relative might volunteer to sit Shiva, and then maybe that's appropriate. The Gemara seems to imply, the Rashba develops this a little bit further, the Rebbe Gamliel had an Eved who he felt was very noble and who he should sit Shiva for, Tevi Avdo. So the Rashba understands that that was a halachic mourning that Rebbe Gamliel took upon himself on behalf of somebody who was not a blood relative. And Rav Soloveitchik was quoted as saying as well that this is the proper approach, let's say, for adopted children who are not actual blood relatives, but clearly Avelis is certainly appropriate on every other level, so therefore there is such a concept of an Avelis that is volunteered, which seems to be derived from this concept, that the Avelis is not only something that the relatives go through and that they have to be comforted, but it's something that the Nifter also deserves to have taking place, and therefore that's what this Gemara seems to be addressing. So based on this idea, the Rambam asserts that Nicham Avelim is a particularly powerful type of chesed. It's a double chesed that acts on two planes, that goes in two directions, and therefore it takes priority over other acts of chesed. And he says, for example, if you have to choose between Nicham Avelim and Bikur Cholim, so you'd pick Nicham Avelim. It takes priority. And Not everyone thought that was so obvious. The Radbaz, in his commentary to the Rambam, he thought that was a very surprising thing to say. Because when we talk about Bikur Cholim, we talk about visiting the sick. So in much of the literature, in the Gemara and later, it seems to suggest that one who is involved in Bikur Cholim is actually involved in saving lives, is actually involved in Hatzalas Nefashos, because the impact that the visit has on a person's health can make the difference between recovering and not recovering. So if we say that this is so crucial, that it's something that's actually life-saving, so how can we say that Nichum Avelim, which is coming after that point, is going to take priority over Bikur Cholim? So that was the whole talk. The Radbaz said he thought this was astonishing. He would have said the opposite. So some of the commentaries on that level at that point suggested an answer which also needs a little clarification. They thought that maybe what the Rambam meant was that if you can do two, then yes, you should do Bikur Cholim first. But if you can only do one, then Nichum Avelim should win. That's also difficult, because if you only do one, then you would think that the life-saving one should come first. It wouldn't just be a question of prioritizing. So that was the whole back and forth in the later Sfarim. And the basic suggestion that the later Sfarim have is that if there really is, there's different types of Bikur Cholim, that if Bikur Cholim really is at the point where you will have an impact on the person's ability to recover, which is often the case, but not always the case, depends on how well cared for they are or what their condition is, all right? So then Bikur Cholim should come first, but assuming that it's not that type of a visit where you're going to have that kind of an impact, so then Nichum Avelim is going to take a priority because of the Rambam statement that Nichum Avelim has this dual effect. That it's an effect both for those who are alive and those who are no longer alive. The Or Sameach, one of the primary commentaries on the Rambam, the Or Sameach thought that there was a Gemara that sounds a little bit against this, because the Gemara talks about on Sukkos that there were people who were very devoted to the mitzvah of lulav, and that they would carry around their lulav all day. And it says that they were holchem levaker es acholul and achem es avelim. If they would go to visit the sick or they would go to comfort mourners, they would take a lulav with them. So it sounds from the order, if you assume it's precise, not everyone thought it should make such a difference, but if you assume that the Gemara is being precise, it sounds like, okay, the first priority was bikur cholim, and the other was nichum avelim. So some of the later Sfarim suggested, some of the contemporary Sfarim suggested, well, yes, that's because it's on Yontif. On Yontif, there's no formal Shiva. So you don't really have Avelis on Yontif. That's why you're carrying your lulav. It's not going to apply in the middle of February. So on Sukkot, so you're carrying your lulav, so then that's when you have no formal Shiva. So what concept is there? There's the chesed for the mace. So the chesed for the mace, that's one chesed. So the chesed of Bikur Cholim would take priority. But the rest of the year, when it's not Yontif, so then indeed Nichum Avelim would come first. That's how some suggest is perhaps what the Rambam is getting at. And there are different calculations that we make when we have to figure out what comes first. Some suggested really this is not a question that we deal with in the abstract, that really every condition is going to be different. If you talk about whether Bikur Cholim, Nichum Avelim, taking care of guests, what's going to come first, it's really going to depend on what the circumstances are, how much are needed in every situation. But in any event, the concept is important nonetheless that the Rambam is addressing, that there is this idea that Bikur Cholim and Nichum Avelim are sometimes related and weighed against each other in this way, because Nichum Avelim has this double component, is this dual chesed, and therefore it's something that we pay careful attention to and has an extra severity. So we have to figure out, what does that mean, Nichum Avelim? How do we understand that term? So Nichum Avelim, so we often talk about that as the Shiva visit, which is appropriate on some level, but a visit doesn't necessarily cover the whole phrase. The word Nichum doesn't necessarily just mean to appear. The word nicha means to comfort an avil. So how do you comfort an avil? It's not such an easy thing to accomplish. So presumably we mean that it means something more than simply appearing at the Shiva house. Although there were among the poskim who thought that that itself is significant. The Prisha on the side of the tour, the Prisha writes that just presence at a Shiva house is itself a fulfillment of Nichum Avelim, because the mourners feel comforted at someone's presence, the fact that people are there, and that's not to be understated. So that is, on one level, something that is very significant. But still, it's assumed that there's more. It still is assumed that there is some type of obligation that goes beyond being present, and that Nichum Avelim, in the sense of actually performing Nichum, and actually performing comforting, is going to require something more than that. Although, parenthetically, it is important to note, I mean, most of us in this room are from the Ashkenazic tradition. In other traditions, let's say, for example, in the Yemenite tradition, so there is more of an approach of silence. That you find that some of the literature actually does hold that up as a high standard, that the Shiva house should be very quiet and people are just there and they're present. And the statement in the Talmud that we'll come back to, which almost sounds a little bit like that also, but in the Ashkenazic tradition, it's a little bit of a different approach. And maybe for solid halachic reasons as well, as much as the other approach is also a very respected approach. But the understanding that maybe Nichum Avelim requires something more than silence, requires something more active than that. So we're off. Sure. What was that better? So, is that better? Is that better? Okay. So we know that there is a phrase that's recited. Again, it's something that differs in different traditions, but in the Ashkenazic tradition, it's common to say, Hamokum Minachem Uschem Besoch Shar Avele Tzion V'Yushalayim. Sfardim have a different translation, have a different format, a different nusach, but we'll focus on this phrase for a moment. The phrase of Hamokum Minachem Uschem Besoch Shar Avele Tzion V'Yushalayim, which roughly translates as saying that God should comfort you amongst the other mourners of Tzion and Yerushalayim. So it's interesting already just first to pick on the word Eschem. So we have this plural usage that we say God should comfort you in the plural, which is also interesting. I remember today is actually Zayin Adar, is the yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's also the yahrzeit of Mari Verabi, Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldbach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the Rosh Yeshiva of Keren Biavna. His 15th yahrzeit is today. And I remember when he himself was sitting Shiva for his brother, the father of Rav Meir Goldbach, and I was in Yeshiva at the time, and I went to B'Menachem Aval, I went to visit him. So I was very nervous about how to do it properly, because the Talmidim in Keren Biavna knew you had to speak to the Rosh Yeshiva in a very careful way, and you had to speak in the third person. So I was afraid to say, Hamok Menachem Oschem, that God should comfort you. I wasn't sure if that was the way to say it. So I wasn't sure if maybe I should say, Hamok Menachem Esther Rosh Yeshiva, speak to him in the third person. Should I change the text? So in the end, I fumfered. In the end, I said, Hamok Menachem, and I mumbled, and I ran out of the house. So I later, somebody showed me later on that they published a sefer of Psakim from Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And they said that somebody asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, says, when you're going to see an Adam Gadol who's sitting Shiva, so should you change, you're going to see a distinguished Talmud Chacham, so should you say the standard Nusach, or should you change it so that it should be a third-person text? And before I saw the answer, saw that the questioner said, I'm not asking Stam, I'm not asking theoretically, I'm going to go see Rabbi Goldwicht, I want to know what to say. So it was my Shiva, it was the same case. So Shlomo Zalman, who had been close with Shiva's brother, so Shlomo Zalman said that you shouldn't change the Nusach, you should keep the standard text. So it could be that this is also reflective of this idea, that's how some of the Sfarim suggest, that this plural usage, Eschem, is because they're not just talking to the Avel. You're saying that there is this dual chesed going on, that God should comfort both the Avel and the Nifter, and therefore you're addressing them both, and you find this plural language also in the different texts in the Sephardi traditions as well, and that perhaps it's also reflecting this idea that we're cognizant of both. We're cognizant both of the mourner and of the Nifter at the same time. So that's in terms of that word. But what about the word Hamakom? So we start off by saying God, and we use this word of Hamakom, which normally would translate as place. So the fact is, in other contexts, we also find God referred to as Hamakom. It's not unique to here, but it's most prevalently associated with this. Nowadays, you say Hamakom, so it evokes this phrase. And in fact, sometimes somebody mentioned to me recently that when somebody davens on behalf of a chola, so you find the text also there of Hamakom, they say they feel uncomfortable because it's reminiscent of the Shiva house, that that's where they remember the word Hamakom from. So first of all, in terms of bringing God into it, so the poskim assume that that's a crucial part, again, of a halachta bedracha, with the fact that we're imitating God's activity in comforting mourners, but also the idea that we then include this in the context of Tzion v'Yerushalayim, that we say that just as we believe that ultimately there will be a redemption and there will be a comfort to all of those who mourn over Yerushalayim, that eventually there will be a geula and will get up from that type of suffering, so too those who are engaged in personal mourning will also have a Yeshua, will also have a Nechama, they're also going to feel better. But the specific reference of a place, so that Tzitz Eliezer has in one of his tshuvas, that this, he thought this was a reference to a Gemara in Chagiga, which says that after the Churban, which we're also evoking here, after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, so God set aside a place, some kind of mysterious place, which is where he sets aside for mourning with the understanding that things will eventually get better, and therefore in the context of a personal Avelis as well, we want to evoke this place, we want to bring that into our consciousness as we express consolation to the mourners. Rav Dessler in a Sefer HaMichtav Melio, he thought there was another intent, that this was also a way of specifically talking to God's role. He says that nowadays, as an expression, people say that time heals all wounds. He says, but really that's not true. That really, the fact that people are able to feel a nechama, the fact that human beings can recover, that's a special bracha from God. That's because God allows them to recover. God gives them the ability to feel a nechama. And we want to specifically distract from this idea of time healing all wounds. We say the place, to contrast with the time, to show that it's God who brings a nechama, and that it's not something which happens automatically through time, but it's an active bracha that God is bestowing upon us. Others suggest, the Kli Yakar has a comment in Chumash, which seems along these lines as well, that the idea is we're trying to say to the mourner that the Nifter, during their lifetime, earned a special place in Shemayim, a special place in history, a special legacy, and that that place right now is the comfort. The fact that this legacy exists, or the fact that this Chelek in Shemayim exists, the fact that this which is left behind is now a legacy for the Nifter, so that itself should be a comfort. So Hamakom, so that place in Olam Haba, that place in the world's memory, all of that, that should serve as a nechama, and that should be something that we should be aware of, that should be something that also enters into our consciousness. So in any event, the assumption is that we do say this phrase, we say Hamakom Menachem, or again, the different versions of it that exist in different traditions, Tenuchamu Min HaShamayim. Also, it depends on, again, what tradition you come from. But it's still generally assumed that that may be a part of Nicham Aveilim, but that's presumably also not all of Nicham Aveilim, that that is something. Some thought it was even really just an introductory phrase, or it was a way of closing. It didn't really count as part of the Nicham itself. Different approaches towards that. Moshe Feinstein had the tshuva where he seems to say like that. But the Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer on Chesed, Avos Chesed, so he assumes that this is part of the fulfillment of Nicham Aveilim, but ideally that's not going to be the whole story. Ideally you're going to say a lot more than that. Ideally you're going to say much more that will hopefully evoke the proper type of Nechama. So we look through the Gemaras. The Gemaras in Mordkaten, which is where we talk about Avelis and a number of other places. So there are many statements where we find the Amoraim engaged in acts of Nicham Aveilim, and we're given a little bit of an insight into how they do it, and we find different types of approaches, but it's clear that they used creativity and insight and instinct and intelligence to try to offer a statement of comfort, to try to talk about a broad perspective, to try to talk about the legacy that was left, to try to put things in context, and to make an effort to say something of substance. The things that you shouldn't say, the Gemara says in Bav Metzia, for example, that the Chaverim Shel Iov, that the friends of Iov, they did the wrong thing, that they said things that you should think, well, this was probably your fault, because of your sins, that they made him feel bad. So that's also important to know what not to say. The Gemara says that's a biblical prohibition of onas devarim. So there are things that you shouldn't say, and there are things that you should say, but it's clear from the Gemara that this was something that the Amoraim were able to model for us as something that takes a lot of creativity and thought and intelligence and judgment to know how and when to say it. Soloveitchik is quoted as saying that he understood that part of the obligation is to convey both in words and in deed that there will be a point later on when you'll be able to move forward, when things will be better, and that we have to do whatever we can in order to both bring that about through the words and also through activity. Sometimes it means fundraising. Sometimes, for example, a family will lose the person who was the primary earner, and therefore that's also a part of their mourning, the fact that they feel bereft in a financial sense, and therefore taking that on is also a fulfillment of Nicham Aveilim as well. The Gemara has a phrase for a shiva house, a difficult phrase. The Gemara in a couple places calls it a Bei Tamya. So what a Beit Tamya means, a house of Tamya. So in one place, Rashi in Maseches Sanhedrin, and we'll come back to this in a few minutes, says it means house of Tam, Shemat'im enoso bedvarim, that you use words to matim. What does matim mean? So matim means to give taste. It also means to give reasons. And probably both are appropriate, that you say things of substance, you say things which give some context and some meaning to the suffering that they're going through. And that's the name that we use for a yeshiva house to indicate that that's the kind of activity that's taking place. So that's a very crucial idea that we have as part of the process. And often we find in halacha that the effort is gauged by the result, is gauged by the impact. So there were those who understood, they quote from Rabbi Chaim Brisker, that there is an idea that the Ovel is actually supposed to actively accept the Nechama, that he has a formal obligation on him to nod, that's how some understood, or to say Amen, to say something which shows that they received the message. And while he phrases it an obligation on the Ovel, it seems that really what we're saying is that this is a reflection of the job that the Menachem did to get through and to have some actual impact. The Shulchan Aruch has a statement that one should not try to be Menachem to Aveilim at once. That one should try to give each Aveil individual attention. And Rav Moshe Sternbach has a tshuva in which he points out that this presumably is not a reflection of the general halachic principle that we have of ein osim mitzvos chavilos chavilos, that we try not to package mitzvos in one unit and try to get rid of as many as possible at once. So that's not what we're talking about. That's not a concern. But it's a reflection of the specific nature of Nicham Aveilim, that Nicham Aveilim means that everyone needs their own personal attention, means they need to be addressed in their own way. And therefore, it's not appropriate for a person to try to cover two at once, but rather should address each individual in their own way, recognizing that everybody's suffering is different and everybody's grief is different. different, and it's going to need its own special attention. That's why the Sitz Eliezer points out, so based on what we said a few minutes ago, that Hamoki Menachem is not really the Nichum itself. It says that you can't say it to the whole room at once. And that's why also, for example, Friday night, if the Avelim come in after Lecha Dodi and they're all addressed at once, that's not really Nichum Avelim in the actual sense. That's not subject to what the Shulchan Aruch says, that you shouldn't address all the Avelim at once. But the actual Nichum that takes place at the Shiva, that should be a personalized experience, and that should be addressed to every individual in their own way. So there are, and that being the case, so there are various suggestions and various boundaries as to when really the proper time is. So not all of these boundaries are really observed nowadays. For example, in some of the earlier sources, you find some of the writings of the Ramban seem to suggest, the later sources have picked up on as well, that maybe the first 3 days is not really the proper time for Nichum Avelim, that Shiva should really take place later. It's a question why that should be. Is the idea that the first 3 days everything's still so fresh, so the Avel is not really going to be receptive? Or is the idea that maybe it shouldn't be receptive because you also have this idea the first 3 days is a time of Bechi, is a time of wailing, so maybe we shouldn't try to be reducing that wailing during that time? So it's a questionable whether or not this is really practiced. The Magen Shaul, Shaul Katzenellenbogen, has a tshuva where he speaks very strongly, thinks this is not really sourced anywhere outside of Kabbalah and shouldn't be practiced. And it doesn't seem in the current society, it doesn't seem from the behavior of most poskim that this is really put into practice. It's something that you do find in some of the literature, but nowadays you certainly find, it certainly seems this way from the way the Rambam describes it, that there isn't such a limitation in practice that one should avoid the first 3 days. What's even less practiced is an idea that you find in fewer sources, that one shouldn't go at night. Clearly that's not in practice. Clearly many Shiva visits do happen at night. There's a tshuva, Afarkasta Danya. Rav David Sperber has a discussion of that practice, and he suggests that the idea is that we're trying to make people receive comfort, and that at night, so people are in a different frame of mind. Often people have a harder time, why people can't sleep at night sometimes, because the things that bother them tend to bother them more. So you're not going to necessarily have success. You should come during the daytime when people are a little more receptive. But again, that's not something that's necessarily in practice. Some of the more contemporary svarim suggest that's just a way of saying that you shouldn't come at times that are inconvenient, you shouldn't come at times when you're going to keep people awake. But that's clearly something that addresses itself to mitigate and to convention, and the current practice does not take that so much into account. Something that is more a reflection of actual halacha, though, is what we find in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, but it's a reflection of really Yoredeya halacha, that one should not try to comfort a mourner when the funeral has not yet happened. It's called Meso Muto Lofanav, before the funeral, so that's not an appropriate time for Nichum Avelim. Nichum Avelim starts after the funeral. And there, the way the commentaries understand is that things are too fresh. And it's not a time when there's any potential to accomplish anything in terms of Nichum Avelim. And some suggest that it's also an offense against the mace, that if we're assuming that this is a dual activity, that we're trying to address both the nifter and the mourners, so then before the nifter is buried, so it's not a time to say, let's get past it. After the nifter is buried, so then we can immediately start that process. But perhaps it's not really in covet of the mace to start talking about things at that time when that hasn't yet taken place. But it seems that it's also out of concern for the mourners, because the Binyan Siyam, back of Eltinger, has a tshuva where he talks about somebody who, Rachman al-Islam, lost two relatives at the same time. And one of the funerals has happened and the other funeral has not yet happened. So can you start comforting them about the mace that already was buried and not talk about the one that isn't yet? So he says, no, it's also inappropriate that this is still a person who's in that stage of grief waiting for the burial of a relative. It's not appropriate to be comforting them even though you'll be addressing the one who has already been buried. So that suggests that really this is something about the mourner themselves, that they have a certain freshness and a certain sensitivity where it's not going to be really fully accepted at that point. But it does start immediately at the burial, right away, as we know, at the Beis HaKvar. So there is the process of Nichum that starts immediately at that moment. And the Sfarim then explicitly say that is a fulfillment of Nichum Avelim, but that's not the whole story. That's where you start, but the idea is we'll then come to the house and have a greater realization of what's going on, and that's really where the mitzvah actually takes place. In fact, the Sfarim seem to suggest that really, ideally speaking, that somebody will visit the Avel every day. That the idea that you come once during Shiva in the earlier sources doesn't phrase it that way. It phrases that one should come every day. So nowadays, with our schedules and with our broader sense of interconnectedness, so it's usually not shayach for most people to visit the Avelim every day. More likely, unless they're very close, they'll visit, let's say, one time during the Shiva. But strictly speaking, as far as the way the mitzvah is presented, so the Rambam and others talk about coming every day throughout the Avelis and trying to express some nechama. So there is a halacha also, which is a little bit neglected which people aren't always aware of, but has important themes behind it. That the Gemara says, and the Shulchan Aruch rules, that Ein Havei, Ein HaMenachemim, Rishayim Ladaber, that the Menachemim should really not be talking, Ad She Yiftach Avel Tchila, that really the Avel is supposed to start the conversation, that the Menachemim are supposed to wait quietly until the Avel starts to speak. So some of the Avelim sometimes are more knowledgeable, more aware that this is their role, and sometimes it doesn't happen. So that's a question, and there were many Gedolim who felt that if eventually it doesn't happen, he doesn't realize he's supposed to start speaking first, so then you're not supposed to leave him hanging, then eventually you do speak first. But this halacha is something that is brought in Shulchan Aruch and is based on Gemara. There's a whole discussion why this is, that some understand it to be a function of Tzidduk HaDin, that it's necessary for the Avil to first, before he starts taking people's comforting, he has to first declare that he believes God is just and that he understands that this is God's will. The situation of Baruch Dayan Emes, of a Tzidduk HaDin, of a recognition of God's justness. And then, only after that, then people start to express Nechama. So if that's the case, it doesn't necessarily have to apply to every visit. It means that overall, the process of Avelus only starts after the Avil is willing to say that. But others understand it a little bit differently, which would be a more individualized thing. That the idea is the Avil has to first give some indication of where he's at. He has to first show where his mentality is, where his sensitivities are, so that the people visiting are able to gauge what needs to be said, how should we respond. But if our whole assumption is that Nicham Avelim is an individualized experience, that it's not something where there's just a formula and you can go in, but that you have to respond to where the Avel is at mentally and physically and psychologically, so then we have to let them speak first. We have to let them express their feelings so that there can be a proper response. One could perhaps suggest that maybe that's the pshat. This is a difficult Gemara. The Gemara in Maseches Brachos discusses the various rewards we get for different mitzvos. So the Gemara says, Agra, the blank, blank. The reward you get for this action is based on how much you do that. The reward for this is based on how much you do that. So the reward for learning is based on how much effort you put into it. Agra deshmaisa svara, for example. The reward for learning is based on how much you think about it. Or the reward for going to a shir is based on how fast you run to go there. So in that context, the Gemara says, Agra de beitamya, the reward for a shiva house, is based on shtika, is based on silence. It's very difficult to understand that, especially if we're saying that we believe you should be talking, that the mitzvah is actually speaking. So why should we say that the reward is gauged based on silence? So it's a little bit of a support for the Taimani practice that the people should sit quietly. But if we assume that there are reasons to take a different approach, so it's hard to understand why the Gemara should hold that up as the indication of how you get rewarded for the chesed of Nicham Avelim. There are some who suggest that maybe it's talking about the Avelim themselves, that the Avelim are silent in recognition of the idea of Ayidom Aron, of accepting the din, something like that. That's also hard to understand because we're not talking about the Avelim getting reward, we're talking about the Balei Chasadim getting reward. So there are some who suggest, well, maybe it's talking about this halacha, that the Avelim should be quiet the Menachemim should be quiet until the Avel speaks first. But that's also a difficult interpretation because all the other statements in the Gemara are talking about the key element that you put into the experience that gets the reward. That's what gauges how much reward you get. So here, this one halacha that most people aren't even aware of, this one seemingly tangential point, that should be why you get the reward. Unless we understand that based on what we're saying, that the whole process of Nicham Avelim is that you have to have an individualized response which is thoughtful and which is sensitive and which is aware of where the person is at the time. And the way that you make sure that you have that is by first letting the Avel speak first and listening to see where they are psychologically and mentally so that you can respond appropriately. So maybe that's what the Gemara is saying, is that Agra de Beitamya Shtika, that the reward for the Beitamya, again, it's the word which is about how you talk to them. Beitamya is a reference to the fact that you speak to them, but the reward for how you speak to the Avelim is based on how well you listen first, based on Shtika, letting them speak first, and then you have that process. So this is one of the key elements, the key aspects of the Avelus process that is very crucial to performing the mitzvah properly. So we're almost out of time. Just mention a few quick other points. So whatever it is, whenever you start speaking, so it is crucial to understand that there's some conversation that's appropriate and there's some conversation that's not appropriate. This is also often neglected nowadays, that people sometimes have a very different atmosphere than one would be expected. Sometimes for understandable reasons, but it's still important to remember that Beis HaAvel is a place where really only appropriate conversation really fits. There was somewhat of a discussion in some of the contemporary halachic svarim that should we say that maybe a little bit of lighthearted conversation is sometimes worthwhile in order to distract the ovel and make it easier for them. And others say, but that's really not what this is about. We're not trying to distract the ovel. We're trying to deal with their grief, and therefore even distracting them for the sake of making things easier for them is maybe not what we're trying to accomplish. Is maybe not consistent with the point of Avelus. So these are among the halachas that are suggested that I have to be aware of. The other also point out that whether or not you wait for the ovel to speak first before speaking, you also have to be aware of when the ovel wants you to leave, when it's been too long. That's a core halacha in Bikur Cholim, but it's also true when it comes to Nicham Avelim, and it used to be in the earlier sources a reference that the ovel is supposed to give a sign that people are supposed to leave. So nowadays we don't really have that, as the Aruch HaShulchan points out, so we have to be even more sensitive, we have to be even more aware of when that time comes, that the time has come to get up. There is a discussion in the Sfarim about whether or not Avelim should be Menachem each other. Do we assume that an Avel is in a position to be Menachem Avelim? Some thought that that was a distraction from their own Avelus and maybe is inappropriate. And others thought that that's the key Nechama, that to be able to say, Imcha Anochi B'tzara, that I'm with you in the same type of suffering, that itself is the best way that one can fulfill Nechama Avelim, and therefore that's maybe appropriate as well. There's a sad topic on top of a sad topic that the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, talks about. And it's a question of whether or not, if people unfortunately don't get along, if you have people who are enemies of each other, so the question in the laws of Bikur Cholim, should they visit each other? Is the question in the laws of Nicham Avelim, should they visit each other? So there were those who thought that it's not a good idea, because it'll just be antagonistic. People will just think, oh, they're just here to gloat. And there are others who thought that a davka is a good idea, because it's an opportunity to make peace. So as the later commentaries point out, so it all depends on what type of mood you can get. If you're able to accomplish that you can make peace through this visit, and turn around the situation, so then it's worthwhile. Another conversation that you find in Bikur Cholim and Nicham Avelim, and we will wrap up in a minute, is that in the context of Bikur Cholim, so many poskim discuss, can you fulfill the mitzvah with a phone call or a letter? Do you have to actually go, or is it something that can be fulfilled remotely with some other type of conversation, some other type of communication? So in the context of Nicham Avelim, you find the same conversation, you find the same discussion in Poskim, but some of the considerations are different. So, for example, the Poskim write that if you make a phone call or you write a letter, maybe you will accomplish the chesed for the Avelim. You'll make them feel a little bit better, but it won't necessarily be a fulfillment for the mace. You won't necessarily be accomplishing this idea of doing something for the nifter. There are those who suggested that if you can't make it to the shiva house, maybe you should do both. Maybe you should make some kind of a phone call or a letter and learn some mishnayos on behalf of the mace. Do something on behalf of the mace as well, recognizing that you're missing that component of the dual chesed. Others considered the question, for example, as one contemporary, Sefer Shailos and Shuvas, that raised the question, so Lamaisa, if you can't make it to the Shiva itself and you're only going to communicate some other way, so what's better? Should you use the phone or should you write a letter? So I thought it depends. It depends on who you are. If you're an actual friend of the Avel and you can actually have a conversation with them that'll make a difference, so then better you should call. In the context of calling, the poskim were worried about this halacha of letting the avil speak first. Because, again, it's not a simple thing. It really is an important part of the process. And it's difficult on the phone to actually let them speak first. So that's part of the issue with this question. But sometimes it's your only option. So some suggest that if you're a friend who can make a difference, so then you should speak on the phone. But let's say you're somebody who's not really so friendly with the avilim, but you want to show honor to the mace. Maybe you're a prominent person. Maybe you're somebody who just by showing up will make an impact rather than the conversation itself, so then a letter might be better because a letter is something that will last and they can show it to other people and it will have that type of an honorary effect, and that's advisable as well. So these are some of the things that we have in mind. I'll just mention one last point and then we'll close, that sometimes there is a question. For example, people who are in yeshiva, so they're involved in Torah study, they're involved in other acts of chesed, they're involved in other important things. So they have a question, how do you balance your different priorities? How do you decide what are you going to do? So normally we have a rule, one who's involved in one mitzvah is exempt from other mitzvahs, so osek b'mitzvah, patim and amitzvah. And the truth is, we normally don't apply this to the yeshiva students. We normally assume that if you're involved in Torah, so that does not exempt you from other mitzvahs, unless it's a situation which can be done by others. So then we say, okay, better if the others will do it, better to stay in the base medrash. However, when it comes to Nicham Avelim, so it seems that's the kind of mitzvah that can never be done by others. Because, first of all, every additional menachem is going to make a substantive difference. So, eino dom Dome, as they say, it's not comparable to have 100 visitors than to have 101. Every additional visitor is going to make a big difference. But also, based on everything we've been saying, we see that every act of Nichama Ve'elim is an individualized experience, that every interaction between an Avel and one who comes to visit is its own special type of interaction. And nobody else can do that for you. Nobody else can be present in the way that you can be present. So therefore, this has this particular type of priority, both because of its dual chesed and because of the individualized nature of its fulfillment, really different than other types of mitzvos. And therefore, it's appropriate on this day that we pay this type of close attention, that we give this type of focus to all the acts of chasadim that we try to do, every way in which we try to imitate God. And particularly this realm, this very painful realm, it's our hope that we can do whatever we can to make it somewhat less painful. I thank you very much. I wish you a meaningful Zayin Oder.
You mentioned that it's best to individualize the nichum. Most houses I've seen, the avelim sit together, the siblings, the widow and the widower, etc.
Right.
There's some houses I've seen where each sibling is expecting a lot of people, so they go in separate rooms. Or chassidim, I don't know if they separate by gender, the women rooms.
Right.
What do you make of that in terms of the ability of the Menachem Avil to properly Menachem each of the family?
Well, the latter scenario would make it easier in a sense, that the fact that they're sitting separately allows you to have a separate conversation with each. It's the question where they're sitting together. And they're sitting together, so then you have to gauge whether you're able to really effectively address the two of them together. Sometimes some of the things you'll say or talk about the nifter, and that will be of interest to both of them in the same way. And then you'll turn the attention to one and say, I know you had a special relationship with your father. I know that... Yeah, your mother was so proud of this, et cetera, et cetera. So it depends on what kind of thing you're saying. So sometimes you can effectively address them together and you will have an impact, and sometimes you'll tailor your statements a little bit more.
Discuss the issue of the mingling of the sexes, whether it's appropriate to be Menachem a woman and vice versa.
It says in the Sfarim that it is appropriate to be Menachem. That's the way it's brought the halacha. It's brought also for halacha. But the assumption is that it won't go into anything inappropriate. So the boundaries of actual propriety and behavior, which vary in different communities, so that continues to apply. But the fact that just the simple statement of a man comforting a woman or vice versa, and also in the context of Bikur Cholim, so it's brought in the Sifrei Halacha that a man does comfort a woman and vice versa. But at the same time, the proper boundaries of where propriety is breached, so that will vary in different societies, and to maintain those while at the same time fulfilling this mitzvah is the balance that each community finds in its own way. Okay. Okay, I thank you all very much.
Rabbi Feldman's book on Chesed and the Jewish Soul is available for purchase from Rabbi Feldman right now.
Okay. Okay, thank you again.
Those of you who haven't eaten yet, by all means. Presentation. And I think we all learned a lot from it. To wrap up our gathering appropriately, continue eating, and just say a couple of things. I know that Rabbi Schwartz couldn't be here today, and I'm sure he would have wanted to be here today. We also have regrets from Mr. Harwit, the past president of Mount Sinai, and someone who's been a longtime leader of the Chevra Kadisha and has been the conscience of Mount Sinai with regard to Chevra Kadisha work. And he also sent a special message that unfortunately health issues prevented him from attending personally today. I think that I feel badly for those who weren't here this morning and missed what is an outstanding presentation. Maybe for the bulletin we can summarize, we can go over the tape and summarize what was said, although it would be a very long article. But in any case, I just want to add one thing, and then we're going to close with our mole. We'll have an abbreviated program. Rabbi Feldman mentioned the fact that today is Zion Adar, and it's the Yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's also his birthday, but that's a topic for other occasions. And that is one reason why many Chevrot Kadisha organize their gatherings on Zion Adar, because it's his Yahrzeit. And he mentioned the reason for that is because this was his Yahrzeit and his burial. And so the burial of Moshe Rabbeinu took place on Zion Adar, the same day that he passed away, we would presume. And the Bon Shalom himself was engaged in that burial, by Yikbar Oso Bagai. And it is for that reason that it's deemed appropriate to have a Chevra Kaddish gathering on Zion Adar, because we're emulating the Rabbona Shel Olam, who Halach Bidrochav, who exhibited this chesed of making sure that Moshe was taken care of properly. And so we learn from that. We also, by the way, learn from Moshe Rabbeinu himself, I like to mention, about Chevra Kaddisha, because when he went out of Mitzrayim, when we went out of Mitzrayim, it's his Mitzrayim, it was Moshe Rabbeinu himself, despite all his other preoccupations, who was engaged in carrying the Aron of Yosef HaTzadik, who had requested to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, and it was Moshe Rabbeinu who took upon himself to supervise the carrying of the Aron as it was being brought during the 40 years to Eretz Canaan. So in a double way, Zion Adar is appropriate for a Chevra Kaddisha gathering, because we learned about the chesed of that's involved in Chevra Kaddisha from this day in a double way, from Moshe Rabbeinu himself, and from the Rabbona Shalom. While the focus in those cases may be on the burial aspect, but all the other aspects of Chevra Kaddisha work with regard to the survivors also derive from the fact that we're engaged in this act of chesed for the mace himself. And that would presume be the act of concern for the survivors. Now, traditionally, we close our programs with a malay. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, we want to mention those people who've passed away since our last Chevra Kaddisha breakfast. And number two, many Chevra Kaddishos, when they gather, the original minhag was that the Chevra Kaddisha itself gathered on the Zion Adar in order to have their day. And it was a day also of mechila beten, of asking forgiveness in case there was some kind of omission or commission act that was inappropriate for the mace, so they asked forgiveness. So our mole now, at this point, for men and for women, will serve that a double purpose. Number one, we'll recall those who are who passed away, members of the congregation or affiliated with the congregation who passed away this past year, and we will remember them. As Rabbi Feldman said, part of Nichma Velim is paying homage and tribute to those who passed away. And secondly, for those who were involved in concerns for the niftar and for the family in case something was done, either not done or inappropriate done, where it's an occasion for asking mechila. So the mali serves double purpose, remembrance and a kind of asking for mechila. I want to thank Hani Hilowitz, who is here this morning with us under trying circumstances, and for the fact that she gave me the list, and I've expanded it also, of people who've passed away during the past year. And if we miss anyone, and if you remember the name, please remind us. It's okay to do that. What we're going to do is say the mole, and then I'm going to mention the English names. I didn't have the opportunity to get all the Hebrew names, so we'll just use their given names. And we'll say a mole for the men and the women who passed away. But if you remember a name that we have mentioned, please do bring it to our attention. And Yoni Ray will say the mole. Go ahead. Say it again. Face the Olam. Yeah. It's not a
tefillah. Give me the names.
I'll put the names in.
Ha metzei menucha nechona
Al Kanfe Ashlina Bimalot Kedoshim Utorim Kezoa Rakia Mazirim Et Nishmot.
We're not Frankenthaler, Henry Amster, Sylvain Braun, Brown, Louis Knorr, Stanley Vermeglich, Herbert Stiefel, Gerald Cohn, Abe Shockett, Yehuda Paltiel, Gerd Valfer.
Shealchu le'olamam, babor vishpachtam danusaka, v'yaraz karat nishmotehem, v'gayen demenuchatam, v'chein bala rachamim, yastirim meseder kedosav le'olamim, v'yitzror v'yitzrachayim et nishmotehem, arunai unachalatam, v'yanuchu b'shalom mishkevotehem, v'nomar amen. Rachamim shochein mamromim hametzei menucha nechona al kanfei ashlina v'malot kedoshim u'teorim kezor arak yamazirim bet nishmot.
Ruth Katz, Alice Hutzler, Senta Okolika, Lily Klein, Henny Lazar, Hilda Rosenberger, Gisela Matzner, Irma Pearl.
Shealchu le'olaman, b'avor sh'mishpachtan nanutz tzakav yaraz karat nishmotehen, v'garein edhem menuchatan l'achein, v'al rachamim, yasirei meteder kenapav le'olamim, v'yitzor b'tzorachayim v'nishmotehen, arunayu nachalatan, v'danuchu b'shalom mishkevotehen, v'numar amen.
Sit down, we'll bench together, and appropriately we'll ask a Kohen to lead us in the benching, because this is his way of showing support for Chevra Kedisha. We're passing out around benchers.